Hello, everyone. Welcome to the inaugural episode of Four J's and a Comic Book. Not two girls in a cup,
but four J's and a comic book. Got dark in a hurry.
Four dudes in a comic standing in a circle.
Oh, no.
I'm John Harder, owner of Waterfront Comics in Suisun, California. And with me tonight is Joe Visha.
Hello.
John Finch from Pandamanga.com.
A.K.A. JP. Hey, everybody.
And the person that's on every podcast is recorded in the 707, Justin Woods from AskAMetalhead.com.
Hey, what's up? And I'm am I the bad penny or the good penny?
I'm going to go with the good penny.
All right. I'd say you're the quarter, man.
I'm the quarter, right on. There you go. You're 25 pennies.
You bring that much to the podcast.
We'll see.
Cha-ching.
We'll see.
And tonight we are going to be talking about one of my favorite writers over about the last 15 years, Greg Rucka. He just released a new comic last week called Lazarus from Image Comics.
So good.
Yeah, it's good.
And we are going to talk about first how he got to this point and then review his webcomic, Lady Saber and the Pirates of the Ineffable Ether.
Ineffable.
That is a hell of a title.
It is.
Yeah, it's a mouthful.
Yeah, I can remember there was an interview that he wrote or something like that where he was talking about, like, he didn't know what the hell he was thinking when he made that title.
The crazy thing is, for me, is the webpage is ineffableether.com, like, instead of, like, Lady Saber, which is easy to remember.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah.
You're going to have a bunch of 12-year-olds out there pissed that they can't spell ineffable.
Mommy, I can't find it.
There's a 39-year-old pissed off that he can't
find it. My phone saved me because I got, like, I-N-E-F-F, and my phone was like, ineffable? I was like, yes!
And then you have to figure out the right spelling of ether.
Yeah, well,
ether?
See, because I played enough Ion, I know what that is because that's part of that super weeaboo WoW game.
I like putting chicks to sleep really in the creepy way. That's what I know about ether. Yeah. Oh, wait, did I say that out loud?
The other ether.
Dark again in a hurry.
Does this rag smell like
just cologne? Kidding. Hey, can you smell this rag? Does. How do you like my, what do you think about my cologne? Apparently she didn't like it. Yeah.
But I digress.
Anyway, back to
60% of the time, it works every time.
Oh. Meanwhile, back at the point.
Yay me.
For those of you listening, we've been at the shop probably for about 16 hours, or at least I have.
John has.
It's the 4th of July, and we just witnessed a huge fireworks show, and drunks tumbling down the street, and you know now it's about midnight, and where everything is funny. So
yes,
if this falls off the tracks, I promise the second one will be a little bit more. Well, I can't even say.
Yeah, no.
You know what though? I have to say how magnificent it is recording a podcast in a comic book shop.
It almost seems
pretty much completely awesome.
It almost seems like sinful to be here after hours, like we snuck into a church or something. Like I'm washing my hands in the holy water.
It's pretty great.
Just hanging out next to the racks of trades. It's sinful.
Freaking Joe. All right, so Rucka.
But I digress again. Greg Rucka first broke onto the scene in 1996 with the publishing of his first Atticus Kodiak novel, Keeper.
He published those in 96?
96.
Wow.
That led to him being, as we talked to our pal John Foltz, about once you get published as a novelist, it's easier to break into comics.
Right.
Especially if you'd write really good novels.
Yeah, he was asserting that it's harder to go the other way. If you go comics then to novels, that's much less common.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that led to Rucka being published in a creator-owned book from Oni Press called Whiteout. It's a great comic, really shitty movie.
Mm. Yeah.
Was it a movie?
Kate
Beckinsale.
Yeah.
But rather than go with the really good source material like Hollywood's apt to do, they just kept kind of like the name only.
Hmm.
And while it worked for World War Z, it didn't work for Whiteout.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it? I vaguely can't barely remember. You would think that I would remember anything that Beckinsale's been in. Mm-hmm.
They're on like an Antarctic research base, and there's a murder mystery.
Okay.
It's a great premise.
Right. It was a fantastic comic, fantastic premise, but, you know, once again, as many movies are from the source material, not kind of miss the mark.
Yeah. Try and fit, well, like 12 issues into like 90 minutes. Yeah. It never works.
I highly recommend the trades, though, if you're into thrillers and crime mysteries and all that good stuff.
Okay, so for the rookie out there, which, you know, I'm the rookie. tell me about, so explain trades. Because to me, that's when I give you something and you give me something back.
You know, I get that a lot. When people come in and they're saying, trades, does that mean like you take our books back? And I'm like, where the term comes from is anything bigger than a mass market paperback, the thing, you know, the pocket size ones,
okay,
is called a trade paperback. Basically, it's an acronymic.
TPB.
That's not the word I wanted to use. A kind of an outdated book publishing term.
But for the context of comics, it's a grouping of...
A grouping of comics. As I like to describe it to people, it is kind of like buying the DVD box set of...
Right. Okay. Right. Oh, that's perfect.
And a lot of the time, it's, you can tell by the way that it's published, it's not the staple type. It's going to be the
book form.
It's going to be, the what do you call it? The glue book, like the glueback book form.
Mm-hmm. It's confusing.
Like a paperback book. Bound, yeah.
It's much easier to understand, you know, when you can see it and hold it in your hand. But when you're using Comixology or something like that, it's really challenging to figure out where you are. Like, for example, with Saga, I bought the first trade or collection, right? They call it a collection, not realizing that I had bought the first. So I'm trying to figure out, like, which ones do I already have? So it's really great to understand what that is.
Well, you know, and on Comixology, I kind of have a hard time understanding what the draw is to get the trade instead of the issues, because typically the issues, like if you were to buy four issues and one trade had four issues worth, it's typically cheaper to just get the issues. But when you get the trade, sometimes they're bigger and it's better paper or something. Maybe there's some extra
back
stuff
matter
in there.
You know, script pages, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I actually found with a lot of them, they're putting that in at the actual comics now and leaving that out of the collections.
The comics have almost always, the comics I've read recently almost always have some back and forth and reader mail and it's really neat. Right, like the writer and the artist, especially the writer, really digs in and communicates with the fans. It's pretty cool. Really.
Yeah, I'm glad that they're doing the reader mail again. That was
it's awesome.
Like the big companies did way back in like the 80s and 90s.
That was always when I was a kid reading those comics. I would actually read the letter columns first.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah.
But the reason why they got rid of it was like anything else, everyone went to email, and now. Email is even kind of a dying breed with Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah, everything's short form these days. 130 characters or less.
Lame.
I don't necessarily agree that it's lame, but
it's sweet if it's somebody that you really don't want to talk to.
We'll be talking in double speak soon, and we'll be double plus on good.
Probably.
LOL.
Well, I appreciate the explanation. Conversely, I have found that, you know, usually they bundle them all together and it's a little bit cheaper, maybe 99 cents or a buck cheaper, but maybe I'm just wrong or maybe I'm not paying attention because usually I'm buying something I really wanted to read anyway. So it seems convenient for me. What I wish the damn app would do is look at the ones that are in the actual collection and be able to discern that you've already purchased it, because I've double purchased a couple of them.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is why
you come to the comic book shop.
To the comic book store.
Well, you know, that's not much help because I've gotten confused and double purchase issue.
That's why you walk up to the front and say, "John,
you bring them back."
Yeah,
I will trade them in for more issues.
I got you on the hook. I want you keeping coming back.
Well, the first one's always free.
The first one's always cheap.
I'm your pusher.
That's what Free Comic Books Day is about. Is getting people hooked on the comics.
Gotta catch them while they're young.
It's actually devious.
It is. Everyone thinks I'm a nice guy, but I feel very devious.
So after Whiteout, what did Rucka get into?
Then he went to work for DC on a Batman huge story arc called No Man's Land.
And he wrote No Man's Land?
He was one of the artists, one of the writers on that. Okay. It was rotating group of writers and an artist on that. But he was one of the big... big cogs in that wheel. And he also ended up writing the novel adaptation, the actual prose novelization of that. Mm. And that led him to becoming the permanent writer on Detective Comics for about 40 issues from March 2000 to December 2002. And while he was doing that, he's also working for Marvel, doing the Wolverine relaunch. He wrote Elektra for about 20 issues and Wolverine until about 2004. And then that was when DC snapped him up to an exclusive contract. And about that time, both Marvel and DC's were having exclusive contract wars where they would lock people up so they couldn't go back and forth to write for the different companies.
That sounds like video game companies.
Yeah, that's when you really can see that the industry was becoming very competitive. Yeah. And there was money to be made.
Yeah. The Spider-Man, the X-Men had all come out by then. So
Right.
So that kind of led to, on the Marvel side, Brian Bendis and Straczynski being their architects over there, and Rucka and Jeff Johns and Mark Waid and Grant Morrison kind of becoming DC's solid architects on their side.
Right.
And so that led to him, you know, basically becoming like one of the cogs in DC Comics for about 8 years. And around that time, he did Wonder Woman, Superman, you name a big iconic DC character, he probably worked on it. And the big thing they did was the 52 event, where it was a comic a week for 52 weeks, written by him, Mark Waid, Jeff Johns, and Grant Morrison, kind of tied everything together for a year and was very successful.
That's not the new 52, right? The new 52 is a reboot of every single character.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that in just a bit. And while he was doing that, he was also created the new Batwoman character, which gained a lot of notoriety and press for being the first lesbian superheroine. And he won some GLAAD awards and that kind of stuff.
That's pretty cool.
And she's actually an interesting character,
too. Yeah.
He's really known for writing a lot of strong female characters. Whiteout.
Oh, Queen and Country.
Getting back to that, he was also working creator-owned stuff for Oni in that period, where he created a great series called Queen and Country, spy series,
set in Britain. Yeah, he did a couple of novels afterward, the Tara Chase novels, and man, she was a great, fully realized character. Yeah. You believed every single panel she was in.
Also a very highly recommended book for me, for anyone who wants to. At the end, we'll do like a little further reading.
Yeah, absolutely. That recommended reading section would be a good thing to throw in the end, for sure.
So finally, getting back to Justin, they decided to reboot their whole line to turn things around and uptick sales. And they ended up irritating a lot of their big creators. Of the four that were kind of the cog in the wheels that I was telling you about, the only one still with the company is Jeff Johns.
Is that the reason why there's been a pretty dramatic drop off in like the quality of story? Because it seems like a lot of people that I talk to are not happy with a lot of the 52 books.
I don't think right now, this is IMHO, getting back to our doublespeak,
right?
That there's too many books for the amount of talent that they have.
They've watered it down.
Yeah. So they're spreading themselves too thin.
They've got a lot of people who I thought were hacks in the 90s. And not the best talent coming back to write 3 or 4 books a month for them.
Wow. Yeah. I haven't seen Tom DeFalco write a book since Thor in the 80s. And now he's suddenly writing 2.
And Scott Lobdell, who is credited with almost killing the X-Men franchise, which is almost impossible to do, is doing 3 or 4 books. And
yeah, that's an enduring franchise.
Jeff Loeb on 1 or 2?
Loeb is with Marvel now. He's doing Marvel like TV projects and stuff. He was one of the first ones who was a quality writer that was shown the door by Dan DiDio along the line. So you can kind of see, you know, just in my opinion, and there's still a lot of very good DC books out there as well. You know, the Batman stuff has been very solid and all that, but I see as a line-wide, there's a quality issue.
Yeah.
But keep buying those superhero books, kids. I got to feed my daughter and wife.
No, there's definitely a couple of gems in there. Like, the most recent run on the Green Arrow has been really good.
Yeah, which was crazy because it was so... Lemire? Yeah, it was so bad for, like, the first 18 issues. And then he comes in 3 pages, completely wipes that out to a new slate.
Right just clears it in three pages. It blew my mind reading that first issue that he jumped on there. And, so relieved.
I can remember how dramatic of a change that was for you. You were talking about relieved. That blown away.
Mm-hmm. I had a subscription to it, and I'm, like, cringing through each of the Annie Ascenti ones. And they're going all over the place and not finishing their story arcs. And then is it Jeff Lemire? This is going to bug me now.
Yeah, Jeff Lemire, yeah.
He comes in, one book, and he takes everything she did, focuses it into a sharp point, and puts it right in the bullseye. Like the Green Arrow is supposed to do.
Nice.
That's awesome.
It almost seems like if you walked into a comic book store today, and you were sort of thinking, okay, I'm new to comics. I've never read comics. What would you recommend? And I like superheroes. Perhaps you might point them at the new 52 arcs and say, start here. Yeah. Right?
So you can get that, in but if, the ground floor.
But if you are a veteran, quote fingers, veteran comic book reader, I don't think that that has any relevance, or perhaps there's no meat there because it is a reboot from my understanding of these series. Mm-hmm. And so that doesn't pertain to you, right?
Yeah.
And so it's very much old Star Wars versus new Star Wars. The Star Wars that I grew up with is completely different than the Star Wars of my kids.
That being said, if the quality's there, you can always recommend it.
Well, certainly, and certainly.
And you know, that's why I have no problem recommending the Batman books from the New 52 or the Green Lantern books, which essentially continued what was going on before, but it's other stuff that's like off the wall, and it's like, I couldn't get through this book.
Yeah.
And it's a character that I don't even know why they gave them a book to begin with.
Hmm. Okay, well, you know, no experience in either regards.
So
Go ahead. I was going to say, my first foray into Batman was Killing Joke, and that's really the only Batman I've ever read.
Well, that's a hard act to follow, to be fair.
Yeah.
And so
really, you either have to read, you know, just the Frank Miller stuff or...
Well, I mean, there's a lot of good Batman books out there, but I digress.
Yes, yeah, I'm sorry.
So I guess the takeaway point from that whole crazy rant was that the New 52 was struggling because they lost people like Rocky.
Yeah.
Right.
And that gets us to this interview that he did in Mark Miller's Clint magazine. Mark Miller had created Kick-Ass and
Wanted,
and he does a book that's published in Great Britain and over here where they serialize his comics, and then he has interviews with other comic creators and all that. Pretty cool format. And so Rekka was
very
kind
of a Japanese sort of format, because they do like the Shonen Jump where it's
an
issue of six or seven different things, mm-hmm. with some previews, and it's kind of a fun format.
And if you don't mind, I'll read a little bit of this interview he gave out. I promise it won't be too boring.
No, let's hear it.
Are you going to change voices?
I'll do my best.
Well, oddly enough, Greg Rucka sounds exactly like John.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I do have more hair, though.
That's true.
More hair and less earrings.
Okay.
I've reached the end of my rope with the work for hire. I'm enjoying writing The Punisher, but that's not mine. It's Marvel's, and I knew that going in. I spent a lot of my comics career in service of other masters, and I've had enough of that for now. I'm sick to death of the way the big two treat people. The big two meaning DC and Marvel.
Right.
I gave 7 very good years to DC, and they took gross advantage of me. It's partially my fault, but not entirely. At this point, I see no reason why I should have to put up with that when I can sink and swim on my own. You know, granted, he's been in the comic business now for 15 years, has 15 successful novels, and he doesn't necessarily need to keep pushing for writing Spider-Man or...
I mean, he's clearly got the chops at this point in his career that he can pretty much do whatever he'd like.
So, and then getting back to the article, you're seeing a grotesque Hollywoodization of the two main companies. There was at least a period where I felt that the way they wanted to make money was by telling the best story they could. Now the quality of work matters less than that the book comes out. There's far less of a desire to have good work done.
Mm-hmm.
Which goes back to our, you know, discussion about where the New 52 is going.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's talking about the powers that be of Marvel without talking me to Creed, that the Punisher is going to join a team on another book and we're canceling your run on the Punisher. It's their choice, they own him, but I don't have to be happy about it. I'm glad I had the opportunity to work on the character, and I'm proud of the work I've done. And probably the most damning thing that he said, despite what the publishers say, their interest in the talent is minimal. The interest is only promoting the financial worth of their properties. That was not the case 2 or 3 years ago when there was exclusive war, but that's all gone by the wayside. Ultimately, they're saying, we don't need you because we can get a million more people just like you to write our books.
So, which is clearly not true.
Yeah.
At all. If you read his run on the Punisher, it takes him in such a different direction that you'd never seen in, God, how many, 40 years of Punisher comics?
Yeah, since the early 70s.
Yeah. And blew my mind. Never been a fan until I read Rucka's run.
So getting to that, I mean, basically the point is that a lot of creators now are feeling unappreciated by the big two companies. And luckily there's other ways now to get to do quality work. And that's where we've now got with him going to do this Lazarus book for Image, basically saying, I'm putting out my own stuff and I don't necessarily need to be the big two and I'm going to be happy doing, you know, with where I'm going.
Yeah, they became movie studios. Mm-hmm. That changes them dramatically.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Image is because pick now up all these good writers.
I mean, they really have. And Grant Morrison's gone there. Rucka's gone there. Brubaker's left Marvel.
There's so many excellent Image stuff coming out right now.
I was going to say, I don't think that I have read in my very, very small, you know, breadth of experience with reading comic books, but I don't think I have read something from Image that I wasn't like, dang, when does the next one come out? God damn it.
Which,
you know,
for us veterans, is the opposite of how it used to be. When Image was started, it was started by 7 breakaway Marvel artists. Mm-hmm. And the quality of the books on the writing side was horrible.
Mm. Yeah. While fantastic art.
Though. Yeah. Well, unless it was a Rob Liefeld book.
Unless it was a... But come on,
Rob.
McFarlane's creator-owned stuff?
Yeah.
The first Spawn? Oh, so pretty.
And the Jim Lee stuff was excellent. Yeah. But now Image has gone from, instead of being, we're putting out superhero books that no one cares about, because if I wanted to read a superhero book, you know, you have 80 years of DC history to draw on. You have 50 years of Marvel history to draw on. I'm going to go with a Spider-Man over the Image Spider-Man knockoff. But now books like Lazarus and Saga, Fatale, it's all fresh and new. And I think it's really exciting time. You know, for us. But keep buying the superhero books.
Buy what you love.
Well, so why don't we talk a little bit about Lazarus then?
Yeah, let's move on to Lazarus. It's came out last week. And the book I thought was very interesting. In the back matter section of it, you gave about 8 pages breaking down how the book came about.
Right, right.
And he's teamed up with Michael Lark, who they did a great comic series from DC called Gotham Central, where it was basically NYPD Blue Law and Order type comic.
Hmm.
It was the Gotham Police Force comic,
Gotham
right?
Police Force, yeah.
Oh, so while, must cross paths with Batman every once in a while, but he's
every
not the
once
main
in
character.
A while, but it was never a main focus. Like, he was in there like maybe once every dozen issues in a panel. You know, it was much more about the
handing off information sort of stuff, not beating down criminals.
Giving Knox grants.
Yeah. And
that was a Batman movie reference. However weak.
I didn't even catch it. What?
Given Knox grants. So in the first Batman movie with Michael Keaton, the reporter guy, Knox. He's in his house at this party and he's like, "Oh, great. He's like, Batman's telling him I love your writing." And he's like, "Great, can I get a grant?" And then Alfred walks in and he's like, "Oh, give Knox a grant." And Knox is like just stunned by it. So yeah.
I've lost my geek card because I don't even remember that scene.
No, I totally remember that now.
That's a great one. That's a really good movie.
Oh, it is. It's a good movie. So.
Well, that's cool. So then the team that worked on Gotham Central got back together to put out Lazarus.
Put the band back together.
Yeah, that's a great team. That's an unbelievably well-reviewed series, right?
Yeah, and what the basis of this is, in the back matter, Greg was talking about him and his son were in New York in 2010 when the Occupy stuff was happening on Wall Street.
Oh, yeah, the 1%.
And
I actually loved this. I loved the premise of this. I read the back matter stuff, too, and I was really impressed with what he starts with, which is basically the first few panels and then sort of this bigger world. And he talks about world building and how he's sort of like, what if you extend that out to the future and it's, you know, now the top...
Instead of 1%, it's the top
0.000. Right?
Yeah. 1/1000th of the 1% control all the world's wealth and resources.
Right. At the family level. So there is no government. Government's irrelevant at this point. Families are, you know, the sort of quote unquote family. And each family sort of, it seems like they have major control of wealth. And so you're either family or you're somebody who's directly in support of that family, or you're what they called waste, which is...
It was family, peasant, and waste.
Yeah, that's it. I couldn't think of the middle one, but yeah.
I think they also had soldier as well, right?
Well, they have the Lazarus, which is the family protector, which is what this character is.
Mm. So the opening pages is... What is her name?
Liberty? Her name is Forever.
Forever.
Yeah. With her basically being gunned down in like the first four panels... And then she awakens zombie style.
Yeah, what a cool scene.
Yeah, right?
She comes up, she shakes it off, and then shows up like in the dark behind these guys while they're rummaging through the pantry, basically. And there she is, covered in blood, eyes dark, ready to just do some mayhem. Such a great scene.
Totally friggin' terrified.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they didn't know what to do. She made quick work of them. Yeah.
Right, right.
And from that, we go into her then being checked out by the family physician. And by family, think of more like a mafia-style family.
Yeah, the family doesn't seem super functional. Yeah.
Right, right.
Not in the traditional sense. They do a really good job of delineating the difference between what the family considers family and what, I guess, the waste, or just not even the waste, was the scientists that were working for them.
Yeah.
Right? What, like, normal people that aren't part of this mafia-type, all-powerful 0001% family, that they have a more traditional, or I guess more modern in this sense, as far as, you know, our current understanding being modern in comparison to this, of what family is. And there's a scene, I think, where she's having to execute somebody.
Right.
Yeah. And he stands in for... You know, one guy stands up so no one else gets
hurt. Right, and she's like, I think that you're innocent. And basically, you know, she says, do you want me to tell your daughter you love her? And he's like, she knows.
She already knows.
She knows. Yeah.
And it's so, if you knew anything about family,
you would know. Exactly. Right. And so it's, I think it's a really neat parallel they're trying to draw, because there's this sort of weird, like, coldness to the way that Forever and the rest of the family seem to interact with each other. It's all very calculated. It's all very controlled. And then in the midst of that, you still have real human beings that do have love and family and honor and like our current understanding of that. And it's neat to have that dichotomy already. Instead of it being such a far removed from our understanding of these concepts in the future, because sometimes in you're doing a real far future world, you know, like building an entire world, far future sort of stuff, that people's understanding of things and the culture is so whacked out and brainwashed that it's hard to find a touchstone within the story.
You really need that little bit of connecting culture.
Yeah, so you can identify with
that. Yeah, to not be totally thrown off into good science fiction.
And so when I got through that, I thought to myself, that was really a wise choice. Like, that was slick. And it was just like a page that addressed that. And it wasn't even a clear plot point. It was just really good writing. Just a fine, you know, very little kind of hint at... There's still people in that world, in this future world here, that still think the way we think. Not everybody's this weird, sort of cold family.
But even to say that, like, you can tell that she has feeling. She knew that this guy was, he's basically just, look, I'm the oldest guy here, obviously. You know, I've lived a good life. I'll stand up and say that I did whatever it was that was done and sacrificed myself for my kids or whatever. But,
right, and she didn't want to kill him because
she didn't want to.
But at the same time,
she did.
Right.
Which makes her flawed, which makes her, you know, sort of more available, I think, in a way.
Right, but it seemed like it was less of a moral hesitation and more of a, almost a point of honor, where she doesn't want to execute somebody who's innocent because that's not in alignment with the sort of warrior values they seem to be slowly sharing with the audience, you know, with the readers. Whereas, like, she didn't seem troubled about it. She's just like, well, this isn't fit. This isn't right. But it's not like, I feel bad about killing an innocent man. She didn't blink an eye.
I think, I'm not sure, because after she kills the first three guys, she's talking to the doctor that's working on her. And she does show some remorse. Mm-hmm. And he's sort of like...
Even when they were clearly in the wrong.
And she's like, look, they just wanted some food, right? And he's like, no. Yeah, nobody else would think that, you know, right? Like, she's showing remorse for doing it or not, like, feeling bad about it. But
yeah, and then they're like, we need to pump her full of some meds so that she doesn't think that.
Yeah, let's make sure she doesn't have these emotional things. But
and also, he tells her, you know, if anyone else was there, they would have slaughtered them and taken the food. And
luckily, it was you who has these engineered the stuff in your blood that helps you surpass death.
I mean, obviously, like the title of the story is Lazarus.
Right,
she can pretty much come back from anything.
Her name is Forever. I mean,
on the cover, she's got a bullet hole in her forehead.
Right.
And she looks pissed.
Yes. She looks pissed and very much not dead.
Yeah. What I think the parallel between family that he's using here is really... Family is just another word for a corporation,
which
is very cold and very, but you know that it's, I mean, really that's what it evolves. I think there's your evolution is corporations have become right now. That's like even in 2013, dynasty. Corporations have become people. Mm-hmm. They have the same rights as a human, right? Which shouldn't be the case. But now the corporation is the family. And here's the thing, like you said earlier, there was this very interesting dynamic between like her and her brother, right? Where, she just got shot 3 times. She's back from the dead. And the brother was like, well, how is she? Oh, she's, you know, or he was very cold about it. The doctor's like, you probably should say something.
You should probably show some affection.
Right. And so he comes over and he gives her this big fake sort of like
tactical move.
Yeah. Right. He didn't, he could give a crap.
Right.
So in that, here she is, the protector of the family, right? You get that. This is her role, but she's being heavily manipulated by these other.
Unbeknownst to her.
She thinks it's genuine.
Way to show that it's absolutely behind her back.
Yeah. She's very much the weapon.
Yeah. And, you know, when as we've discussed it, like, I got the family thing. Like, it immediately when I was reading that. I was like, oh, you know.
Well done.
But as we talk about it more, I'm like, God, there's some brilliance there. Because he didn't beat you over the head with it, but he made it clear enough.
There's a lot. This is a meaty 20-something pages. I mean, it's there's a lot there.
And it's a great first issue.
Oh, hell yeah.
You want to come back and see what's going on.
And there wasn't some kind of cheap hook at the end either. It was just like... It left you on this very compelling moment instead of a what's happening next. It's, you know, they're hanging off of an edge. It's more like they left you with this wow moment instead of kind of a cheap cliffhanger, which I always respect because the cheap cliffhanger still makes me want to come back. But there's this sense of kind of like, oh, come on, you know.
No, he's really good at finishing his thoughts and still making you want to come back and read more.
Way compelling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was pissed that the book was over. I was like, really?
You're like, no. What?
Well, you know. is being someone that's new to it, you're used to reading more of the collections,
right? I've been spoiled with, you know.
Now you know what's been going on with us for like years.
Well, I've been going through that with Chew because you know I read through the entire first 31 of them or whatever. And now I have to wait like the rest of you. I'm like, you know, awful. I'm like I'm in the background slapping the veins on my arms, going, when's the next Chew coming out? But now, you know, luckily you can subscribe to them on Comixology now, and it just
buy them at
your local comic store. Do we have to have the explanation as to why Justin doesn't buy comic books? Do we have to go through that? Look, I read on a tablet. Just makes my life easier not to have, because I'll be obsessive and I will have. I'm standing. Okay, we're sitting in the back of John's comic book store, and there is a 15-foot wall that's 6 foot high, and it's filled with trades. This would be my house, because
it's almost.
And I would and you know, like this is what it would look like, and. Because I tend to be a little bit of a collector of things sometimes.
Sure.
And I just know from my own capacity that I can't have that. And so it makes it way easier for me to buy my stuff on a tablet. And that's one of the first things. That's how John and I met, really, technically, is like I called the shop to say, look, with all due respect for the medium, you know, I prefer not to buy comic books because they'll get destroyed at my house. They just will, you know, much like everything. You can't have nice things because you have teenagers or, you know, whatever. So anyway, I don't have anything against print. I love print, but it makes my life easier to have them on a device that I can read while I'm in bed at 1 o'clock in the morning, trying to fall asleep and not have to have a light on, which would keep my wife up, et cetera, et cetera. So the more I come into the store, the more I'm like, I'll just buy it. You know, I'll just buy it. And I resist because I know that.
Well, it's because space is the final frontier.
It really is.
And bits fit very well on a small hard drive.
That's true. It's not the size of the hard drive, man. It's how you use it.
So what do we all give this comic on the rating scale?
So what rate? First
yeah,
of all,
how do we want to rate?
Scale? Do you want to do the 1 out of 5 issues? When 1 to 5 issues like we do, or stars? Or
I like your 1 to 5 issues scale.
Yeah?
What's that?
Okay, so over on Pandamanga.com, our Geek Life podcast, we came up with a way to rate comics because we do so on a regular basis. And our scale is this. It's 1 to 5 issues. Think of it like 1 to 5 stars.
Right.
Except there's an added level of complexity in that basically that speaks directly to somebody who is a comic book person. Because when you come in and you see issue 1 of something, you pull it up, you read through it, there is an intrinsic value that extends beyond the book itself. You read the book and you go to yourself, based on the experience of reading this book, I'm thinking that if I went in there and there, you know, was the next five issues available, right, I would buy this many more.
Gotcha.
Without even opening it up. You wouldn't buy it one at a time. Because, I mean, let's be honest, like, not trades so much, but the issues in a comic book store within a few months, it's temporary. They're not going to be there, you know? Mm-hmm. That's why everybody comes in on Wednesday when they come out and they get them. If you come in even a couple days later, if it's popular, but it's not one of the big, big, big titles, it's gone, man. And so that's kind of the thing is that if you like something and it's on the shelf, it's like you buy it.
Gotcha.
You know, because it's not going to be, it may very well not be there. And so it's coming from that sort of a cultural perspective of comics culture. You go, okay, I read one issue. There's this many that I could buy. Mm-hmm. And based on this, would I buy as many as I could? You know, or would I be like, well, I'd give this another two issues. I'd buy two more issues right now without even looking at them. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a complex sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Luckily, it works a lot better with conventional comics when there are multiple issues available. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we stumble all over ourselves trying to have an opinion about something that's like a one-shot indie comic or something like that. Because it's like, how do we reconcile our system with that? But with this, it works really well.
Cape was four issues long.
Five issues on the show.
Yeah. Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, you have a pedigree writer. I mean, he comes from a long line of working on some of the most well-known comics out there. Mm-hmm. And for me, I immediately subscribed after reading it.
Yeah.
I cannot wait for the next one to come out. Yeah. And so I was immediately like, this is really an interesting story. The world is interesting. I'm interested to see more. Are there other families? What's their Lazarus? You know, are there going to be interplay,
yeah,
right?
It's, yeah, so, it's rich. So what would you give it, Justin?
I hate to be like so easy on it, but I would have bought the first five issues of this easily after thumbing through this.
For sure.
But you'll find from me, like, I'm pretty instant gratification driven. Like, I like instant gratification. So,
well, that's one of the reasons why it's good to have a bunch of people on a podcast, is you get different opinions. Right. You know, one of us is likely going to kind of rise to the surface as a hard-nosed type reviewer.
Right, right, right.
And then there's probably going to be someone more like yourself who's a little more forgiving and more willing to look for the good. And that's good. It's good to have... It's good to have the whole range. That's
well,
why.
I mean, I don't want to sound naive. Like, I can be a dick. I can be judgmental, right, and I can be.
I mean, but just,
you know, I can be critical, right?
Right.
But in I was immediately. I think in the first, I think for me it was the first and second page where I was like, "This is totally cool." Like,
you
this
don't
idea,
have to work to like this.
Yeah,
you don't have
this
to go
idea, along. And the art is really fantastic.
Yeah. There is nothing that gets in the way of the story. Sometimes art gets in the way of the storytelling, and you have to look past it to be able to appreciate it.
No, not at
that
all.
That is not at all what this is. The art, it's so good.
It is really good. So for me, literally, like, if I had walked in and I was like, what's new, what's good? And if John had said, give this a whirl and handed me them, and I read through like the first few pages, I would have been like, I would have easily been like, how many of them are there?
Right, yeah.
Because for me, this was that good.
Yeah, this is definitely something I see myself reading more and more of. So five for you.
I think it's going to be a consensus five issues for all of us. I mean, Joe and I are big Rekka fans to begin with.
So. Makes me want to go back now and read some of the other stuff that this guy has done, because this is so good.
Yeah, I've been, you know, long-term borrowing Joe's trade of Queen and Country, and I immediately pulled it out. Yeah, okay. That's where it is. So.
And at the end of the podcast,
I pulled it out.
I'll give us some recommended readings.
For sure, yeah. So, John, where do you lie on the scale here?
Well, I would definitely, you know, I was looking forward for this when it was first announced with the creative team.
Yeah.
And after giving a reading, it definitely didn't disappoint. And I'm actually going to, I is a little like behind the scenes of how I read. I generally trade weight and wait till the whole story is out. On this one, I'll be picking it up and reading every issue when it comes
out. Sure, sure. So, Joe.
As big a Rekka fan as I am, I gotta give just a hair less. Go a 4.5.
Oh, yeah, by the way, you can do half issues, even though that doesn't make any sense.
But don't come into the store and rip an issue in half.
No. I only want half.
You don't want to see John get mad.
You wouldn't like John when he's angry.
I never
like
read any of his superhero books. Like, I am only familiar with his novels and the Terra Chase and Whiteout, all the, like, crime thriller stuff. Yeah. And while this has, like, you know, the little bit of that in, you can kind of see some of the similarities in the story structure. It's a big different take on anything I've read from Rekka. And it seems like a little bit of a slower burn than what I'm used to with, well, with sci-fi anyway. And it's hard for me to reconcile the slow burn build up to this friggin' awesome crescendo Rucka that I'm really familiar with the kind of drop you into the story and kind of expose you to everything all at once that I get in most of my sci-fi. So it's going to take me a couple issues to reconcile those two worlds, but it's going to happen, and then I'll read every frickin' issue he writes.
Did you read this as sci-fi? Because I don't know that I did.
I didn't come up with a sci-fi feel.
The only indication of any...
This felt sort of dystopian to me.
Sci-fi influence in this was the fact that she had been... there's something that they've done for her on a physical level that's all very plausible with things that are even, you know, and that's one of the things he brought up in the back was, you know, only last year in Sweden, they did this. 6 years ago, they did this. We're already seeing these things.
It's a logical extension.
Right, yeah. Right.
I actually found kind of that explanation terrifying.
Yeah, right.
Well, in light of, you know, everything that's going on in the United States right now with spying and, you don't know what you don't know. What is it? There's some statement about I'm okay with when my country does this to other countries, but not when they do it to me, right?
Sure.
I can't think of the exact term, so.
Right. It's like you can dish it out, but you can't take it.
Yeah, just ignore that thought. But yeah, so anyway.
This definitely seems to be leaning into the assumption, I guess the only kind of sci-fi, like you said, is the ability to heal and stuff like that.
Well, and
what you were saying. Well,
but also the really dystopian, society that all the peasants, I think they even say, engineer the food and clothing. And
it seems like this might get into some transhumanism stuff. I don't know if that will be a issue that they're going to deal with. Like, it will very likely in our near future be an actual political issue. But that's definitely an element in this. They obviously have engineered somebody to be more capable of survival than before, and she definitely holds a certain role. And it doesn't seem like the whole family is invincible like her.
Right.
So.
Right.
Well, I think that I'd go probably 4 out of 5. I really liked it a lot. I thought that it was really compelling and interesting. It's hard to give anything much higher than that without knowing more. So it's almost a little unfair to, like John was saying, it's always nice to wait for the trade. Because, even if there's going to be a bunch of trades in the end, typically they're going to put as much as they feel is a nice complete thought, a little picture of the story in a trade. And so you get a more complete thought, you get a little bit more fleshed out what's going on. You might go through some small story arcs and move some character progression in. It's easier to get a real honest glimpse of what the comic has to offer long term. But I really did like this a lot. I think the art was really solid. The more that we talked about it, the more that was sort of revealed to me in retrospect about how brilliant and subtle the writing is.
Mm-hmm.
I can just now, looking at the comic as Justin flips through it a little bit, I can remember when we were talking about the first scene that was action packed and had really compelling and powerful drawings and amazing palette and use of light and dark, and just really just this gritty scene of her dying and coming back and taking these guys out. And the whole time there's this narrative that's going on later. It's all a flashback, and she's recounting what happened to the doctor.
Right.
And
right.
And there's times where she's like, I don't want to talk about it. And the doctor's like, I need you to tell me.
Yep.
And so not only are they explaining and defining the edges or the technology that's available in this world and who she is and what she's capable of, but at the same time, Rucka is managing to start to develop internal conflict and turmoil with the character and a relationship between her and another character. Like, it's really damn good. It's really damn good. I'm looking forward to the next issue quite a bit. Yeah.
It's funny because as you read this, it's being revealed to you, but I don't know that you ever... I think in many cases, the fourth wall for this type of media is you have to remember that this guy probably has all of this written out, maybe even in novel form already, right? So imagine what you would do to prepare for, let's say you're going to prepare for a presentation. We'll simplify it, and you're creating a PowerPoint that's 10 slides. So you know what the next slide is in the deck, but your audience doesn't, right? But you've already done all that preparation. It's not a surprise to you. And so you see where I'm going with that? We look at this and we're like, he's already started to flesh out relationships and all of this stuff. And there's probably a magic there, right?
Yeah, but he's probably got them long since.
Oh, yeah.
All figured out.
Oh, yeah,
he's
yeah.
been able to go back and add subtleties.
Yeah, and which is...
It really feels like you're looking through a small window into a larger collage.
Right, right.
We can't really appreciate everything that's going on, but there's obviously a very rich world that's going on that's supporting the events in this.
Yeah.
More going on that we don't really know behind the scenes reminds me of something like Star Wars, where that you see a piece of the story, but there's technical manuals coming out the yin-yang that we're never going to know that's simply there to support what's going on in the background. And you'll see people, creatures, characters with weapons and armor and stuff that maybe somebody sat down at one point and wrote out pages upon pages about what they are and where they came from and why they look that way and mm-hmm. how their technology works and the history of their people. And we're never going to know those things, but it's just beautiful when someone takes the time to put something like that together. And I get the sense that there's a lot more to this world that he may never even really go into, but knowing it as a writer himself and speaking from that place of that sort of rich background, mm-hmm. I think that feels like kind of the direction we're headed.
And getting on with that, I'm going to switch gears to the next thing we're talking about, Lady Saber and
yes.
the oh, yeah. Pirates of the Ineffable Ether.
Ineffable.
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 And I'd rather be effable than ineffable.
That's true, yes.
And I picked this because I thought it would be in your guys' wheelhouse of, you know, you generally review a lot of webcomics.
We do.
And after he left DC and went to finish his work with Marvel, he created a web comic with his longtime collaborator, Rick Burkett, who they did a lot of Batman stuff with at the start of his career. And the Lady Saber is a steampunk pirate, very lighthearted adventure.
And like a similar kind of a space thing going on, too.
Yeah, space, and along with some Western.
A little Western bit of Western,
yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. And
mishmash.
I was aware of the comic for a while, but it wasn't anything that I would go out of my way to read, you know, when they put up their 2 pages a week, because I'm another guy that, like I said, I like to wait for a complete story to be done.
Right.
So they kickstarted the hardcover for the first 5 chapters, which is going to be about 200 pages, done widescreen style, 6x12 widescreen, I believe right. is the dimensions.
Right, and they kickstarted the shit yeah. out of it. They had like...
They went for their initial was they wanted 27,500, which was reached in 8 hours.
Right. Huh. They got what, over 500,000?
They
for
ended
it, right?
up with $143,000 okay. on this. And yes. with it, they were able to increase it, unlocking major stretch goals. So now when you, with the Kickstarter for the $30, you get the hardcover, the first 200 pages, the 5 chapters. A script book hardcover, a
nice
small pocket-sized journal, Lady Saber journal, and then also in the book, poster-sized foldouts of the deck plans of the ship.
Wow. Now, this is already finished.
Though, it was already finished, right. but they are doing, till the end of July, they're doing, for the people that didn't have credit cards and only could pay through PayPal, you can jump on it with PayPal and for $30 get all this stuff as well.
So at ineffableether.com, you can go on and get all these cool goodies.
And
for just $30, you said?
$30 for...
Nice, that's a sweet deal.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I mean, even someone who doesn't like print
might... Hey, I might just go do it. Because I, you know, as I was reading through it...
last longer.
As I was reading through it, I found it to be quite enjoyable. Well, so, okay, let me just tell you a story, right? So I'm a big poster. I collect movie and concert posters. I have an original 1975 trifold Star Wars poster, a linen backed, in my garage that I just need to frame.
That's awesome.
That I paid divorce level money for, right? Like, I came home from LA one day and I told my wife, like, I was bad. And, you know, she, her eyes got huge and she's like, what do you mean you were bad? And I'm like, I spent $1,100 at a poster store. And she was like, what? You know, and I bought a lot of posters. Like, I got some Slayer stuff that I'd never seen before, you know, all like silk screened. And so anyway, there's a book. There's an industry book about all of these artists that do all of this silk screening stuff all over the United States. And I got it for Father's Day. She went out and bought it. It's like 2-inch thick, giant, weighs 25 pounds, right? I forgot that I had this book because my daughter borrowed it and had it in her room. And she went and, like, I told her, look, if you don't clean out your room, I'm taking your Xbox for the summer. The next day, she cleans out her entire room. That happened to be Father's Day. I come downstairs and there's this beautiful book sitting on the, I have a little hallway and there's a, like, a kind of a, like a, there's cabinets there in the hallway mm-hmm. as I walk down the stairs from my bedroom. And I see this book and I'm like, oh my God, is that the book? You know, and I flip it over and I'm like, oh, this is the greatest Father's Day gift ever. And I take it downstairs, but there's a whole shit ton of stuff on the table. And I'm like, there's more? And then I ask my wife, I'm like, where did you find this? And she goes, well, it was in Savannah's room. And I'm like, what do you mean it was in Savannah's room? That's my daughter's name. And she goes, we got that for you last year. And I, you know, it was like I facepalmed because I hadn't seen it in a year. And that's why I don't buy comic books. I don't buy stuff that I don't want to disappear in my house because, I mean, unless I like, I have to like shuffle it away and put it into my office.
Right.
I'll never see it. And so like, you know, I spent the week shuffling through this book and oh my God. So anyway, that's why I don't. I know it's ridiculous, but you know.
No, it's understandable. You got to find space.
But I do buy stuff for my kids. I'll buy the books for my kids. Like we came in and I spent $50 a piece on my kid on books, you know. I Vampire and stuff like that. So
it's like giving you crap.
I know. It's good. And I love taking it.
And paying for
it. Yes.
Yes.
So what do you guys think about Ineffable Aether? What was your... I guess we'll start with John.
Yeah, well, I only got a little over an issue in, or a chapter in. And it looks like it's going to be really interesting. But there's so little story that happens in the first chapter that it's hard for me to really...
Yeah, the first chapter is basically a fight scene.
Yeah, the first... Mm-hmm. Yeah, and...
Which I thought was really cool, by the way.
Yeah, you know, I...
It was kind of...
Very swashbuckling.
Yep,
yeah. Very, very Pirates of the Caribbean kind of things. You know, fighting around on something. Everybody had sword... I mean, like, they had this, what looked like very futuristic-looking gear, and they're standing on the top of what looks like a blimp-type thing, and...
Well, I love the reveal of that, because they're fighting, and then on the next page...
Pulls out, it's...
Yeah, it's like...
Oh, there's a great, like, angled panel... there's such a cool layout, where there was this... Almost looks like a spiraling sort of angled panel, where the character jumps off of this blimp onto this beautiful starry background and just falls through the air, sliding, you know, like falling past this very, very cool scene. So, you know, story-wise, I don't really know. I don't think, if you were to ask me to give it a rating, I don't think that I could honestly give a real rating.
I was more along the lines of, like, you being webcomic experts.
Right.
You've reviewed 100 webcomics by now.
A lot.
I mean, is me who was used to reading comic books rather than comic strips. I liked how the layout was, how underneath they put the script pages for the page.
That's different. The thing that stood out to me the most as far as specifically a webcomic format was that I've never in my life seen somebody commit so with abandon like they did to the widescreen format. They were doing like really interesting things with the widescreen format. They would do, not just because I'll do like a, you know, 5x or 8x5 sort of put a page size on our site, because you know that's the way the internet works, that's the way the computers work, it's all widescreen anyway. But what they're doing on Lady Saber is crazy, because the widescreen is huge.
I can see, like, when the print book comes, everything being like a double page spread.
Yeah,
like
right,
300 was
right, exactly. And I think that on top of that, they would do a really, really wide frame, but they would do it like double high. And so it was hugely wide, but you also had to scroll. And so instead of having kind of the choice of, okay, everything's going to fit on one frame or on one screen and it'll be legible and beautiful because it's stretched to the widescreen format that is common on computers these days, or you're going to have the sort of vertical rectangle sort of look of normal comics, where you're going to see probably the first maybe 2/3 of the page and you're going to scroll down to see the rest of it if it's going to be at an appropriate size for you to see all the information and for it to be legible and appreciate the art and everything. It's almost like they combined the two. And so at first it was like, whoa, what's going on here? This is a really huge picture, which, to be fair, took a way long time to load on my on the mobile browser, which is how a lot of things get read. And it looked amazing once it loaded, but you know, web design wise, I don't know how much of a great choice that is, but I think that I was blown away. I thought it was really cool layout wise to do the big wide format like that.
Whereas me, I read it on my 22-inch widescreen monitor.
Right, which looked great,
I'll bet. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that they really took advantage of the computer widescreen format in a way that I think is way unique and very progressive. I think that artistically, I found it a little stiff, and like the poses seemed a little stiff. On the whole, it was great. The action scene was really intense and fun. The backgrounds were beautiful. The starry sky and the frame layout was like really brilliant. But there was just a handful of moments where it just felt like that probably should have had like a reference or something for the drawing more. It did. It seemed like how somebody would imagine someone in this situation being, but lacking the little subtleties of actually going from reference or something like that.
I found, because I read the first five chapters, basically what will be in the Kickstarter book,
right,
that the first chapter, they were kind of getting their sea legs underneath them.
Yeah.
Pardon the pun.
Their air legs.
But and as it progressed, they kind of were doing this for the web, and it progressed more from the stiffness to you actually could tell, because Burkett's a great cartoonist.
Sure.
And
that was my first reaction. That was like, wow, this is the best art I've seen in a web comic in my short.
It's definitely heads and shoulders above most.
I mean, it's definitely a professional. You can tell they're professional.
Yeah.
That have been in the industry for years and years and years.
Yeah.
But you know, going through the five chapters, you can see a progression that they're getting more comfortable with doing, you know, a page each.
You know? Well, and it's more and more common with a webcomic to have the art style really progress. I think that, I don't know necessarily how it worked out with this particular comic, but it seems to be that people are a little bit more willing to be like, well, let's throw it out there before it's really ready and just let it develop as it goes.
How often is the release?
It's twice a week.
That may be why right there.
And it's...
But you know, if you're releasing twice a week, unless it's like one of the few things you're actually doing, it's very likely that they'd done it previously. Like they probably had quite a bit of a backlog. I mean, obviously these guys are working at a professional level. And so I have, in my own experience, I have no clue what their turnaround time really is. Because for me, as an amateur artist, it takes me forever, you know? And so I don't have any idea. I can't really make an educated guess even how long it would take for them to do that kind of stuff. But two full pages a week is quick, especially with how big these pages are, because these pages are easily all a double wide page, almost all of them, especially later on when they get the bigger set pieces towards the end of the battle.
What I'm going to be interested in seeing is, now that the Kickstarter is funded, one of the stretch goals was they bought Rick Burkett a new computer setup with a new Cintiq and all that stuff.
Ooh.
So I it's going to be interesting to me to see, I guess it'd be chapter 9 will be the next one after the Kickstarter, to see if the art even progresses further using the new technology.
Could be. Could be. It would be interesting to know what the workflow really is.
Well, I got into the third chapter, and I definitely recognized a lot of the Rucka subtlety. Like, it was, in the first chapter, it was so subtle that there was kind of nothing there.
Right, there wasn't a lot of story in the first chapter.
There was a little bit of, like, hints at stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I would just say, if I was reading this as they came out, it would drive me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, just getting one page, you know,
that's the thing about webcomics, they do drive you crazy.
I don't know how you guys do it.
So, typically with webcomics, they are not a ongoing drama that takes the liberties that a normal comic book issue would from page to page, where they don't have to worry about what, or about keeping you or hooking you to come back next week to see what's on the next page. They can just be like, oh, this flows better and this explains what's going on, and we don't have to keep them, we don't have to have every page go, wow, what's coming next? And so they obviously went with a more traditional comic book style here.
I did feel like each page was, wow, what happens next? I can't wait till Thursday to check this out.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the webcomics are tricky like that. I was thinking that it would be fun to do releases, and this would only work if you had completely finished the work before you start releasing. Mm. But I would like to go through and completely finish an entire issue before I even talk about it and begin to release it on the site. And I thought it would be interesting to release them in like what I'm kind of fondly calling blasts, a comic blast, which would be, instead of releasing a page twice a week, like release five pages on Wednesday, like a bunch, enough to tell a piece and let there be connecting pages so that you don't have to have every page have that sort of weird up and down rhythm of the, oh, what's coming next, this hook every time. Mm-hmm. It would be nice to be able to have some transition pages and not have to have everything have that much impact and make you want to come back every time. Mm-hmm. I think that would be probably one of the, if not the only way that I can imagine of having a natural, more traditional comic book issue feel, is to be able to release a bunch of pages and not just a bunch of pages in a week, because you still have to ask somebody to wait a whole damn day or a whole couple days in between it. I don't think that's realistic if you want to try and tell a story like that.
There's no other medium that I can think of that does that. Like, I just thought in my head, I'm going to start a band, and on Monday we're going to release the intro, and on Wednesday we'll do the first chorus, Friday we'll do the first verse.
Because one page of a comic does not come anything right. Where near constituting an entire song. No. It's not a complete thought.
No, right?
TV shows can kind of do it. They can,
but even then,
they can hint at the next episode and then do the next one as a two-parter.
But I mean, even that, it'd be you still get 15 minutes, like, right? You get the first 5 minutes of a TV show,
yeah,
and then same bat time, same bat channel on Thursday.
You know, yeah, it's minutes. Really brutal.
Oddly enough, and this isn't a joke, I often thought recently, since in the music industry, why put out a full 60-minute album when everything is singles and everything is, you know, it's like you have this pressure to put out this huge album and then go tour it. Most bands, I think, you know, why not just put out 3 songs now and then next quarter put out another 3 songs, but have the quality of those songs be really far superior. When's the last time you listened to a current, you know, album that it wasn't metal where every single song on the album is really, really standalone, fantastically good?
I would say not only is that not common, but it seems to be getting less common. I think that idea of we don't release anything unless it's a single with 5 tracks or a full album with 12 or more or like that. Like, I think that that's honestly becoming sort of antique. The guy over at Pandamanga, we should talk to him about sponsoring some music in for Waterfront's podcast, but talking with him about... Tiger Paw is the guy's name. Tiger Paw over at Air Plus Recordings, airplusrecordings.com. Little plug, very good music.
I think the intro and the exit should just be I Am the Law by Anthrax. There you go. I'm just going to raise my vote for that.
Well, you get a hold of Anthrax and see if we can use it, okay?
I got the song on my iPod.
No, you got to talk to Anthrax or whoever it is that publishes them.
What are these rules?
I know. Anyway, so the idea with the way that a lot of the DJs and the electronic artists work is that they... A lot of the time we'll release compilations with a bunch of different people on it together if they're going to do an album, or they'll release kind of this, like an EP instead of an LP. You know, they'll release something with a handful of songs and they'll release it every so often. It's pretty regular. They come out with songs all the damn time. And, you know, obviously they're growing and progressing all the time, but it's not so common to get an album with a bunch of songs unless it's a compilation album anymore, at least in that realm. And I know that that's, you know, it's more electronic music, but it also, along with all that feeling, it is way more progressive in the way that they go about their business and the way that they go about interacting with their fans and releasing their music. And I think that that's kind of where we're headed, is like you're saying, you know, instead of waiting 6 months to a year to put together an entire thing, that doesn't work anymore. Everybody's so incredibly impatient. It's all, you know, 130 characters less. It's bite sizes. Give it to me now. Give it to me now. Give it to me now. If you put out a song or 3 songs every month or so, you're going to stay. You're going to kind of maintain a mind share in the people that are interested in.
Right.
But if you put out an entire album once in a really great while, people are going to care about you for a month and then they're done. And so with the world being the way it is, with trying to maintain people paying attention to you all the time, because that's cash money. If you know how to use it, having people like reading your blog every day, you know, checking out your Facebook, retweeting your tweets, reblogging your blog posts on Tumblr, all that sort of stuff. When you have people consistently, like part of their routine is to consume the content that you're putting up. If you do lots of little bite-sized stuff, you're going to stay, you're going to basically maintain, like I said, a mind share, if you're familiar with that term, like a mind share. You're going to maintain a chunk of their mental space at all times.
Right.
And that's what you want. And so the idea of doing it once in a while is really falling out of favor, because we don't have that luxury anymore, because everybody's not doing that anymore. Everybody is expecting something quickly, all the time, fast, fast, fast.
Well, the idea came to me, and I would like to claim this is an original idea, but the idea came to me when I was purchasing songs on iTunes, and I realized, like, well, I really love this artist, but on this particular album, for whatever reason, There's only three songs that I really like off this album. It was a weird period for the band. They brought in a new singer. They brought in a new whatever. But for so many of the albums that I buy the entire album because every song is good. You know, there's just, but that's because I'm a fan of the band or,
sure,
you know, but there are Metallica albums where there's three songs on the album that I really, really like. And that's it. You know, well, there is no real, in Justin's Metallica world, there is no Load and Reload albums.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Those don't exist on Justinville. I mean, for example, you know, like Sandy Anger, there's three songs that I really like. So why put all 11 or whatever songs on my iPod when I'm only ever going to listen to three? So since I can buy them individually, why not have the band produce them individually?
And better yet, why not have the band put out a bunch of extra stuffing to fill the space if they really feel... Because, I mean, you'd think that somebody, a band that is as accomplished as that would... be able to go, these are the songs that are really excellent.
Well, most bands go into the studio at that level with 40 or 50 songs, right? I mean, that's one of the things they do is they whiteboard all the songs, they play the songs evolve over time. And so there is some soul in the music that gets put into it by that song being played over and over and over again, and it changes and it grows and it becomes, you know, it lives and breathes and it gets to the final point where it's like, well, look, we can't make any more changes to it. Look, it just has to be what it is now. Let's get it on the album because now we're at $1 million for the cost of this album at this point.
Right.
But what if you could be a little bit more, I don't want to say spontaneous, but a little bit more organic to say, well, you know,
instead of polishing those 40 or 50 songs down to 10 songs,
which is what they do.
What if you put out a song a week and you get all 50 songs for the year?
Well, you'll end up with crap,
but that's
unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But
you're still going to get the couple of ones that were going to be diamonds.
But imagine all of the distillation that they've done to go from 40 songs down to 9 or 10 or whatever, and still 8 of those songs are crap. So I guess, yeah, I think the whole point of it is, look, you can more quickly produce it. You can more quickly get it out there. I can continue to be there. You know, I hate waiting 4 years for a new album to come out from somebody. Like John and I, you were talking about Chimera today, and I was trying to get you, you know, turn you on to Chimera. And like, just by chance, I Googled to show you one of the band's songs, and like, holy crap, there's an album coming out on the 30th. And I'm like, now I'm excited. Now I have a show that I want to go to in August.
Right.
So anyway, I don't mean to derail the...
Right. So how does that work into
the web. So right. What I was saying, it really came from, if you put out a page... That page has a moment of thought for the storytelling that you're doing. And then I sort of, when I brought up, well I'm going to play the intro on Monday and the first chorus. I'm like, there's no other medium that does what you do with a webcomic.
Yeah, that gets away with that, really.
That gets away with it. You have to be dedicated. You have to be incredibly patient. And ultimately, you have to go out of your way to consume that media, right? And I guess what I was getting at, which sort of, I went off on a tangent about this idea that I have about that. But ultimately, it was sort of like what you were saying, which is like, let's blast out 5 pages. Here you go. Here's the complete thought for this small section of the story that's going on. Next week, we'll do the same thing and we'll give you a little bit more meat.
So the ongoing challenge with all that is that any creative medium that is done well and right is unbelievably time consuming to make it happen.
Well, sure.
Mm-hmm. And you just... You know, as excited and greedy as we all are as artists and writers to get our stuff seen and maintain a certain level of attention with our fans, like, it's not sustainable to be able to continually keep people interested in what you're up to like that. You have to kind of go into hibernation for a while, put together something that's masterful, and then release it in pieces, sure. But the whole, like, create it, put it out. It, as much as that can be fun, and as much as we do that, and different people do that and are really successful at it, it has a pretty low ceiling for impact, I think.
Hmm.
You know, it's not going to be something like, just today I purchased Maus, and I was like, you know, this is an unbelievably powerful comic. John was telling me they're using it to teach the Holocaust in school. And,
right.
You know, it's like, that's not something that they were going to be like, okay, I'm going to put a page out a week or something. You know what I mean? It's something that takes a huge amount of thought. It's a masterpiece. And so... You know, it's like you have to choose what you want to do. And so webcomics are either going to need to evolve in the way that they, you know, release, like I'm talking about, with a kind of a blast sort of an idea, which even then, who knows if that would really work, or they're just going to have to lean into the whole, go back to comics roots, which are the Sunday funny strips.
Yeah.
And just keep doing that.
Well, that's kind of what I felt reading this, was it was like the Prince Valiant pages, where you, Sunday... Read one, and then,
you got a little bit of fix, and then you had to wait a week. But yeah, with the web attention span as it is, we are not going to get a Moby Dick anytime soon.
No,
and if we do, no one's going to put up with it. Pass. Call me Ishmael.
Well, I mean, I have this thought that if it's already written and you're just piecemealing it out, why? Why are you doing that? Why aren't you giving
to maintain attention over a long period of time?
And that's, and that's, you know, all it is. It's a rhetorical question. Yeah. The question is that the only way to drive traffic to your site? Yes, you have to. And, you know, what is the purpose of that? Is it to drive traffic to your site so that you have, so you can say, well, look, our webcomic is getting X number of hits a week, and that's mm-hmm. what relevancy is. And again, you know, it really distills it down to being a commodity, which is a bummer, because in the case of this particular comic, like, I was reading through it going, wow, this is really neat, you know? Like, the art is great.
I think we can all collectively agree that reading one page after the next sequentially in mass is the most organic and natural way to experience a comic.
And most fulfilling.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the webcomic thing is, it's fickle. It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
You know, as much as we enjoy that and have a good time with it, it's odd. But obviously, at this point, you can go check out ineffableether.com, and there's so much good stuff that you could sit down and spend a half hour or longer reading through it and really get a big bunch of the story. I mean, they're beyond there's, what they're going to put out in that hardback.
There's nine chapters up right now.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. that's almost twice as much as they're going to put in that one book. So
yeah, worth a read.
Yeah, way worth a read. I'm going to go home and read more of it. I didn't get a chance to read as much as I'd like, and I want to read more.
Well, I'm going
to
sleep first, then do it.
Yeah, sleep first is probably
what. It's about, what, 2 o'clock in the morning right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, probably.
It's barely 1.
It's exactly 1. It just turned 1 right now.
Is officially the 5th of July.
It's 2 o'clock Central Time.
So do we have any final thoughts about Rucka, Ineffable Ether, and Lazarus?
Again, I'll give it a 5. You know, I read 5 issues of it in one sitting, so...
Yeah, the only reason why I didn't read more was just human latency, just time,
Yeah, I want to reserve, I don't feel comfortable giving any kind of a judgment yet, you know, any kind of a rating, but definitely worth reading and interesting. And I mean, shit, it's a webcomic, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean,
free and easy and available. Yeah. I think that I would be really interested to see how the hardback comes out and how they're going to display this widescreen format that is so clearly laid out.
I know, like in December.
Yeah, it's exciting. Yeah. It's exciting to see what they're going to do, because that's something that I kind of struggle with. It's like, how much are you going to commit to one way of doing it? And these guys just went balls to the walls, just crazy. Like, let's just go nuts and do like 100% all in web-based viewing. Let's format the comic in such a way that it really shines in a widescreen format, which is not the way comics go. So it's like, how's this going to fit on a shelf? Is it going to be awkward? How's it going to read? Like, it's going to be really interesting. I'm excited to see how they do it.
And it's free, you know, mm-hmm. which is another.
The print format, I'll be really fascinated to see how they put it together. Mm-hmm. So, very cool.
All right. So
do you have some suggestions, John?
Give us your recommendations.
Recommendations for Greg Rucka. I will go with both Whiteout trades from Oni Press. All 4 Queen and Country Omnibus is also from Oni Press.
So good.
If you liked Lazarus, I will go with the Gotham Central run that Rucka, Ed Brubaker, and Michael Lark did. Some of the best quality books that DC put out over the last 10 years.
Brubaker was on it too?
How the book worked was Rucka wrote the day shift and Brubaker wrote the night shift.
That is cool.
Oh, dude.
That's pretty cool.
And finally, Lazarus. And check out Ineffable Ether. Great, great read. And a little preview for next week. Greg Rucka's collaborator on Whiteout was Steve Lieber, who came out with a book with Nick Spencer this week called The Superior Foes of Spider-Man. And while I expected not to even want to read the book, it got great Twitter reviews. And I read it, and it was probably one of my favorite comics I've read in the last few months.
Awesome.
So we'll do a little bit about that, and along with a graphic novel review or two. We're trying to decide whether we want to take a Western theme or a Kaiju Godzilla theme. So
yes.
Come back next week to see what we decided.
Excellent.